You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 2nd of March, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Of course, it's Truth Will Out Radio, so that means we must have Dennis Wise here, the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told. Dennis, how are you doing on this freezing cold Friday evening?
Freezing. I'm reporting for duty. I'm having a bad week.
Yeah, the snow hasn't managed to keep you away from podcasting.
Not at all, no. Take more than that.
Yeah, definitely. This is the thing, isn't it? I mean, you can have all this terrible weather outside and not be able to get out, but at least we've still got the internet. We can still communicate and contact each other. That's quite amazing. That's right. You talk to people all over the world and remain in contact. And, you know, it really has helped nationalism, the internet, I think.
And, we wouldn't know a fraction, would we?
No, well, we wouldn't have your videos.
You know, that's true.
This is the thing. And we've got a new one as well, haven't we? We've got a new video, part 11 of the Secret Masonic Victors of World War II. We covered it a little bit a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? And now the video is actually out and the public have seen it. And we're going to discuss that tonight. But just first off, before we get into that, I'd just like to remind people about Alison Chablow's trial, which is next Wednesday at Westminster Magistrates Court. That's the trial for singing funny songs about Jews. And that will take place at 9:30 in the morning. So if any of our listeners that wish to go and support her, please do. Please do go and show your support. There were so many people last time that they actually had to change the venue of the court to a larger courthouse. And the journalists themselves that were covering it, they mentioned the fact that she had so many supporters there. It really is helpful to have supporters there. And she's going to be on the Daily Nationalist with me on Monday as well, talking about the court case. But if the Truth Without Radio listeners don't all listen to the Daily Nationalist, that's why I'm saying it today. So that's next Wednesday, Alison Chablow in court at 9:30 at the Westminster Magistrates Court. As I say, but today we're going to be talking about the new episode of The Secret Masonic Victors. And I watched that today. I've taken some notes. I've also got comments that we're going to address. And the first thing that I really wanted to bring up, Dennis, was about the Bloody Sunday footage with the tank at the football match. And I thought, that can't be real. That's got to be exaggerated. And I looked it up on Wikipedia, and it's got Bloody Sunday, and I was reading about it, and I was thinking, well, there's no tank in this. You know, this has got to be an exaggeration.
Dennis has lost the plot.
Yeah. I was like, what's going on here? Have you gone all Hollywood on us, Dennis? But no, it was, there's two Bloody Sundays. There's one in 1972 and there's one in 1920. And the one that you're showing was from 1920. And, I'll just read out exactly what went on there, and then maybe you can talk a little bit about it.
Sure.
Bloody Sunday was a day of violence in Dublin on the 21st of November 1920 during the Irish War of Independence. In total, 32 people were killed, including 13 British soldiers and police, 16 Irish civilians, and 3 Irish Republican prisoners. This includes people who were mortally wounded but died later. The day began with an Irish Republican Army operation organised by Michael Collins, who we're going to hear about later, to assassinate the Cairo Gang, a team of undercover British intelligence agents working and living in Dublin. IRA members went to a number of addresses and shot dead 14 people, 9 British Army officers, a Royal Irish Constabulary officer, 2 members of the Auxiliary Division, 2 civilians, and 1 man whose exact status is uncertain. Later that afternoon, members of the Auxiliary Division and the RIC opened fire on the crowd at a Gaelic football match in Croke Park, killing 11 civilians and wounding at least 60, 3 of whom died later. That evening, 3 IRA suspects being held in Dublin Castle were beaten and killed by their captors, who claimed they were trying to escape. Overall, while its events cost relatively few lives, Bloody Sunday was considered a great victory for the IRA, as Collins' operation severely damaged British intelligence, while the later reprisals did no real damage to the guerrillas, but increased support for the IRA at home and abroad. And that really surprised me, Dennis, because, you know, I saw the clip and I thought, well, that's got to be exaggerated. Well, no, it wasn't exaggerated. They really did go into a football match and just shoot everyone there. And yet this was a victory for the IRA, because that was a response, yeah, wasn't it?
The sympathy goes with the IRA, doesn't it? Or with the, you can see the brutality of that action and you're going to get a swing of support, aren't you?
Yeah, but also, I mean, that was a reprisal for what the IRA had done, and they took out this Cairo gang who were, you know, providing all this information on what the IRA are doing. I think you mentioned the Cairo gang in the episode as well. Can you tell us a bit more about them?
Yeah, well, these were regarded as legitimate targets. They weren't civilians. These were members of the intelligence who been planted in and around Dublin to pick up information and obviously to feed it back to the headquarters. So these were, Michael Collins actually found with his informers addresses of these British informers, and so set out on Sunday, on Bloody Sunday, to reap the vengeance. But like I said, they were regarded as legitimate targets because they were actually, you know, working for the British, if you like.
So they were double agents, weren't they? They were traitors to the cause, I guess, to the Irish nationalist cause. And it had been stated that is what was going to happen to anyone that informed on their own people. They had been warned. So despite this, you know, this... I mean, it's an awful attack, isn't it? You imagine you're playing football and a tank suddenly appears on the pitch and they start shooting everyone.
This is revenge by the Black and Tans for that. This is later on the same day, late afternoon, where, as you say, just crashes through the gates, pulls up in the middle of the field and they start shooting. The thing is, I don't think we'll ever know exactly how many people died in that episode because... you had to register a death in those days, and it was that expensive. And with the person already being dead, you know, a lot would have took them, you know, that it just weren't worth it. So we'll never quite know, but they did fire quite a number of rounds, so into a, you know, a bit of a crowd. So it's going to be always going to be a problem.
Well, that's really barbaric, isn't it, at a football game? I'm really shocked to see that. I really did think that was, you know, a Hollywood exaggeration. And I think that actually went
well, that guy did say, didn't he, shoot, the more you shoot, the more I like you.
But there was a reason for that, though, wasn't it? I mean, because they thought...
Well, I'm not sure, no. I'm not sure. I just think that was... Churchill had organised these to go over, and there's some... later on, I mentioned that Brian Ingalls, this is a guy who used to do all that yesterday, many years ago. He was a bit of an historian as well, and he kind of came to the conclusion that there were dregs from British jails who'd been sent over in exchange for the freedom, and they'd carte blanche to do whatever they did, and they did whatever they did without any retribution.
Well, that's the same as what goes on today, isn't it? I mean, it was all the dregs of the jails that were set free from Libya that were sent off into Syria. And Saudi Arabia frees the people in the jails in Saudi Arabia if they want to go on jihad in Syria. So it's the same thing there. But I mean, what it was the Black and Tans were a reprisal because the IRA decided they were going to do guerrilla warfare. So they were going to attack civilians. So the guy that was speaking to the Black and Tans, he was saying, pull your gun out. If they don't put their hands up, shoot them. If they've got their hands in their pocket, shoot them. You know, he's saying shoot first, ask questions later. But there was a reason for that. You know, it's like.
But he also says that no names will be mentioned in any inquiry.
Oh, yeah, it's obviously dodgy. And the guy that actually said that, I believe he was killed soon after, wasn't he?
About a month later, he went to Cork, Cork is an IRA stronghold in them days anyway. And he went to a meeting and they got word and, that's, you know, unfortunately, that's what happened to him.
Well, next up, we've got a really informative comment, and that's for, this is from Mikhail Romanos. And he says, Michael Collins did the only pragmatic thing, which was to sign the treaty. No one wanted it, but Lloyd George had threatened terrible and immediate war, worse than what was already going on, if the treaty was not accepted. The anti-treaty IRA was swiftly defeated by the Free State forces, so that should tell you what would have happened. Ireland would have got no counties back, let alone 26. As Collins said, it was a stepping stone to full independence. Sadly, he was murdered before he could have helped bring that about, and it was an Irish bullet that killed him, not a British one. The real traitor in this situation was Eamon de Valera. He knew the British would never accept a fully independent republic, which is why he sent Collins to the treaty negotiations to take the blame. The coward set Collins up to save his own reputation and started a pointless civil war in the aftermath. De Valera, real name George de Valero, was also of suspected crypto-Sephardic Jewish origin on his Cuban father's side. There's a lot of evidence that suggests de Valera was a secret British operative who was turned following the 1916 rising in order to save his own life because he was terrified of dying. Michael Collins was a true Irish patriot who did more for Ireland than any other Irishman in history. The real traitor was the snake de Valera. So what was happening there then, Dennis? What was the treaty that was going on that that the people didn't like? And also, what other background do you know on de Valera?
Yeah, well, de Valera was one of these who was in the uprising for 1916 and imprisoned. The reason why he wasn't executed this year was because he was an American citizen, and that kind of got him off the hook. But there's also the story that he did a deal with the English and became like a double agent, if you like. Whether that's true or not, you know, it's just up for debate. But he certainly became the leader, the political leader, shall we say, of the IRA when everybody was free. And Collins was kind of the organizer of the kind of on the foot soldiers on the ground. So consequently, when it come to this this Anglo treat, I think the English called for it, and the IRA were happy to oblige, and the 5-man delegation went along to London, and I think Collins said along the way that he wasn't experienced enough to deal with these negotiators, but in any case, they signed the Anglo peace treaty, and also he had to swear allegiance to the King George the Fifth. Which he knew would annoy a lot of people back home. And he actually said at the time when he signed it that he knew that he'd signed his death warrant, which obviously came to pass.
And I think at that time as well, when he signed this treaty, it was only a provisional government that was put in place. And it's only ever since then been a provisional government, according to the treaty. And yet, according to the EU, this provisional government has signed themselves in as part of the European Union and all the rest of it, and they're treated as if they are, it's a sovereign state and it's a sovereign government. And yet it's not. It's only a provisional government. And there's a website, Billy Maguire, he runs it. I'm not sure what the name of the website is, but they have a turn-in of the sovereign seal once a year, and nobody seems to be doing anything about this. But they don't actually have a legal government in Ireland, and it's as if the country was taken over at that point from the point of this treaty. Do you know anything about that at all?
Yeah, well, I mentioned right at the end, I'm just trying to get it up now. I mentioned right at the end that when they signed that treaty, they actually became a de jure state, and that it is recognised as being the legitimate government of a territory over which it has no actual control. So therefore, it was technically still under the crown. So, you know, these negotiators would have had the edge on the Irish for sure, because these are people who've been, you know, been used to this for quite a long time now with all the empire. So consequently, Collins was out of his depth, I think, signed the treaty, hoping that it would be a stepping stone, but consequently upset a lot of people, because at the end of the day, this is not really what the 16 died for, if you like.
And of course, later on, you've also got the IRA falls prey to the Marxist brainwashing. They started out being against Marxism. And of course, later on, they were wholly supported by it. All of communism.
And I think it was subverted later on as well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's move on to the next comment. And this one's from Alibaba. Okay. And Alibaba says, "While I love watching this series because it is very informative, I don't really see the linking thread between most of these events and the titular Masonic victory of World War II. Will this be explained sometime later, maybe? So what's the thread between all of these, Dennis?"
Well, there is a common thread going right through it, and that is this war between Christianity and Freemasonry, which has been going on for quite some time now. And all these revolutions, apart from the Irish one, it was started by the Jews, if you like, in this world revolution. The difference with the Irish one was that the actual empire, the British Empire, I think should be called the Masonic Jewish part British Empire, because the infiltration took place, as I've explained, after Cromwell and years after that. Once they got the country into debt, then they take over. You know, they do that with every country they go into. So consequently, it's called the British Empire, but I don't like to call it that, because the last person to ever go at anybody British, you know, they, at the end of the day, they've been infiltrated and occupied, just like Ireland had. But the Irish were trying to break away from this with these nationalists. And the only one who was a socialist, as far as I'm aware, was Connolly, who was shot in the chair, if you remember. And even then, I think he was more of a nationalist than a socialist, if you like, especially if he's, there's not many socialists today are nationalists, as you can imagine, but he was prepared to die for it.
Yeah, people often get that mixed up when they hear national socialist. They think that it means, you know, something to do with communism, but real nationalism is socialism. If you're going to be standing up and advocating for your ethnicity, that doesn't just mean the best of your ethnicity, that means the worst of your ethnicity as well. It means you stand up for all your people and all the classes that are involved, and you understand that the farmer is just as important as the intellectual. And, you know, this is a big mistake that people make that don't really properly research nationalism. They believe what the left say, that, you know, we're just all about supporting capitalism, or else they believe that when we say we're national socialists, they think, oh, well, that means we support communism. And really, it's the third way. It's against capitalist exploitation, and it's also against the collectivization and all your property going and equality and all that nonsense that we get on the left. It's just about following natural hierarchies and following the natural order and trying to conform to that and forming governments based upon that, which is what Adolf Hitler did. And I believe when Adolf Hitler died, it was the Irish government that said something positive about it. Are you aware of that?
I'm not. It doesn't surprise me, because obviously Adolf Hitler was fighting for Christianity in Europe, and obviously Ireland was a Christian country, so that doesn't surprise me. They kept neutral during the war, but in this particular part, this era, I know that they received some arms from Germany while they were fighting in World War One.
Yeah, this is all taking place like 20 years before.
Well, that again is the link, because the guy who wrote the comment, I actually said to him, for now, just think of it as this is going to be, you know, 20 years' time, this is the army what's going to be fighting Adolf Hitler.
And the Jewish influence, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that we see Cromwell goes over and attacks Ireland, and Cromwell was the guy that brought the Jews back, and the attacks on Ireland and the taking over the land, that all took place all at the same time as these Jews were coming into England.
Kind of doing the Jews work for them, weren't it? Because as we saw in all the other episodes, French Revolution, German Revolution, it was a Jewish kind of rebellion against Christianity.
And it's taken over the land as well. I mean, it took over, like, what, 95% of the Irish land?
That's right.
And up until then,
what was unique about them was the fact that most people are dominated by a majority, but Ireland were dominated by a minority.
Anyway, but up until then, there was no animosity between the Irish and the English and the British. You know, these Irish, there's a record in Alfred the Great of these Irish monks coming over on a coracle, and they were heading on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and he entertained them at the castle. And there's records in Wales of Welsh saints going over to Ireland and Irish saints coming over to Wales and sharing monasteries and sharing universities, you know, sharing the language, that the Ogham script, I think that originates in Ireland, and we've got a lot of that on stones in Wales. The early Christianity was, you know, it was Wales and Ireland and Scotland and England. And there was no animosity. It wasn't up until this time with Oliver Cromwell. Yeah. Sure. You know, once he rejected the church, really, and tried to start his own new church. E. Michael Jones makes it really clear there was no excuse for that in Britain. You know, there's no excuse for it anyway, really.
No, at least it was just a looting.
Yeah, yeah, a looting operation. At least in Germany, they had Martin Luther and his theses, and, you know, they had some reasons over there. But in Britain, it was just about taking the church's property for the king.
Yeah.
That's all it was. Well, moving on, the next comment we've got is about the Marxism side of it. And we have the nose behind the curtain. And he says, it's a shame, but Collins and his people had fallen for Marxism, had they not? And there's go on.
Well, I was just going to say, we just said that I don't think at this particular point the IRA had, but for sure, when the trouble started in Northern Ireland, you know, you have people like Gerry Adams, people like that, who I believe are Marxists even today. They're certainly pro-EU and pro-immigration, of all the traits of a Marxist.
Well, that's why Corbyn and these others in the Labour Party supported them, didn't they? They supported Sinn Féin. And I heard that what would happen is when the Americans would be over there in the summer holidays or whatever, that they would hide all the Marxist books in the bookshops. And once the Americans had gone back, they'd have Chairman Mao and Stalin and all the rest of it in these bookshops. Yeah. So you'd be saying one thing to one people and another to another.
Well, just to say, Corbyn obviously is a student of the Fabian Society, so that shouldn't be a surprise to people.
Well, Mikhail Romanos again, he's the one that gave us that information on Michael Collins. He says that Sinn Féin was subverted by communists in 1962 under Thomas Gill. Since then, there has been a variety of splits. The Provisional IRA was formed in opposition to the communist official IRA led by Gill's supporters. Unfortunately, the Provos were also subverted. The only true nationalist party in Ireland today that stands for the principles of genuine Irish nationalism is the National Party, led by Justin Barrett. And the National Party are a fantastic nationalist party, and Justin Barrett's speeches are excellent. They're all available on YouTube. He's brilliant. Can't fault him. Everything that he advocates for is National Socialist, without actually saying that he is a National Socialist. And, you know, he's really, really passionate about what he says, and he, you know, he really gets the audience going with his speeches. He's great. I think we're going to see really big things from him, from Justin Barrett and the National Party. But, this started in 1962, Dennis, that Sinn Féin were subverted, and that was why the Provisional IRA split from them, which I was unaware of.
Yeah, well, I was as well. I mean, I know there was a campaign around World War II called the S Plan, where the IRA was in England causing havoc. But other than that, I know little about it.
Yeah, I just know that they're communist today. There's obviously a point when it happened. And, you know, that would seem to be the time, 1962.
60s, yeah. Sounds right, 60s,
doesn't it? And we've had the same thing with Plaid Cymru, the Welsh Nationalist Party. They started out saying that Wales only for the Welsh and got to speak the Welsh language. And now they're total communists. They want to open up Wales to the whole world. They don't want any limit on the refugees. So, you know, they've said they want to make Wales as a sanctuary country for anyone that wants to come there. Same with the SNP. Same with the SNP. They started out as proper nationalists. They got subverted and became communist. It seems to be a thing with these nationalist parties from then. Yeah. From, I guess, these parties that began in either in the 40s or the 50s or before then, and then they gradually all became communist, ran about the 60s. That seems to be the time.
That seems about right to me.
That seems to be the time. Well, we move on to a different subject now, and this is from the Squad, 2391. And he says, why skip the forced genocide of the 1840s, which was England's third attempt to genocide the people of Ireland? The Masonic hand is all over the so-called Great Famine. There was no famine. Check out a site called irishholocaust.org. Also, why skip past the mass enslavement of our folk by Cromwell and those Masonic puppets that came after him? The English and Irish common folk were the first slaves in the New World. Again, the Masonic hand is all over this. Well, I've got some quotes on the white slaves, and I've also had a look at this the so-called potato famine. I know you have as well, Dennis. Should we go into the potato famine first? Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't gone into great detail, but what I know I can talk about, it seems to me that from what I can gather, like the guy said, there wasn't a famine, or certainly wasn't a natural famine. The case for people eating just potatoes isn't correct, I believe. And not only was the potatoes taken away, but all the other kinds of food as well, from your cattle and your sheep and your poultry. And these were did three layers of sounds very much like the Bolsheviks in the Ukraine, by the way, whereas if they got trouble, they had, the farmers gave them trouble, they had a police who would come and sort it. If they couldn't sort it, there was a division of soldiers, I believe, and then if that didn't sort it, then they did bring a whole lot of army in, but they never once failed to get the crops.
They took everything, didn't they? There was a shortage of food, I think, on the continent. And also on the mainland in England, people were eating potatoes all the time and they weren't growing enough to feed them. The same as today, we don't grow enough to actually feed ourselves in Great Britain today. We have to import lots from everywhere else, which is really ridiculous way of doing things. We should be self-sufficient. But they certainly weren't self-sufficient then. And when it came that they got a little bit short, they just went to Ireland and took everything. And the excuse they had for that was, well, we own 95% of the land, so all the food that's grown on it is ours. And they starved the Irish. And there was refugees that came over to Liverpool and they were treated very badly. There's information on that site about what happened to the ones in Liverpool that's never been acknowledged. And they claim that there was just under 6 million Irish that were genocided in this famine. And I would question that figure, because I would suggest that a large number of them may not have actually died. They may have just gone to America or gone to Australia, because there was a lot of travel to the colonies at the time. And we know that America and Australia are filled with Irish people. And it was probably from about this time. It wasn't all slaves that went over there. You know, if they're starving and these boats are going off, these ships are going off, they're likely to say, well, take me on board as well. You know,
they arrived in a pretty pitiful state, I believe, when they did get to America. They were starving, and the clothes were hanging off them, but they managed to get over there.
And again, this is, as you say, this is like Stalin in the Ukraine, just taking everything so that they can make money from it. And apparently there was also even reports of people in England saying, well, this is going to be our way of thinning out the Irish, getting rid of the population. It's got shades of that Jew that said that Germany must perish, saying that, you know, we've got to wipe out these Germans. How can we wipe out the Germans after the war? Well, we'll starve them and we'll put them in these camps, and then that will cut down on them. And this is instance of the same thinking. You know, we forget quite how barbaric we used to be. I mean, I can remember reading in the British histories, I think it was Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, and they're talking about, I think it's talking about invading Denmark, and they're saying, "Oh, we'll just kill everyone. We'll just kill everyone there." And that was the idea. And I don't think it was just the British. I mean, the people that would invade us. I mean, you take the Anglo-Saxons when they invaded the country, they killed everyone in Britain apart from who could escape to Wales. You know, 90% of the Welsh that were inhabiting what is now England were either killed or had to move into what is now Wales. I mean, this was a common thing. You know, you were either killed or you were enslaved or you fell on your sword. You know, this is why I've always said that when Hitler had the British army in his hand in Dunkirk and he allowed them to go back, the laws of honour state that Churchill should have said, okay, you win, because he had him at his mercy. Because the rules of war are either you kill them or you enslave them when you take their land. And in America, you know, nobody's ever been so gracious to a vanquished enemy as the Americans were to the Indians. They let them have reservations. When in any other case throughout history, if you go to war for a territory, you have to wipe those people out. You can't allow them. You can't allow them to live and make them citizens with you. You could do if they're the same race because you get into breed with them, but certainly not otherwise, because you've got an alien people there. It's just common sense, and we seem to have forgot that. And
it's not a British way of thinking. Not a true English way of thinking, should I say.
Well, you've got this Jewish side to it as well, which is a profit motive, isn't it? I mean, this was all about a profit motive. This wasn't about conquering new lands. This wasn't about going to America and finding a land for the savages. This is our brothers next door in Ireland. Yeah,
there's this agenda of getting rid of the white race. Well, the Irish came under that.
Well, they certainly... slandered them, didn't they? And when they got to America, they said that they were, not up to the standard of other whites. But I think they've got the same IQ as anyone else. I don't really understand this looking down your nose at the Irish. I don't know. Really
no, I
where
don't.
That
but
came
I,
from.
The Catholic thing comes into it with the Jews, or should I say the occult side of it?
Right. Because I often discount that. You know, not. Being brought up a Catholic, I don't, you know, I know it's a lot more acute for you when you see these things. Dennis. Yeah, well, I know when you said before, you know, about Guy Fawkes and the 5th of November,
yeah,
how that's completely different for you than it is for everyone else.
It's nothing I celebrate.
But there's still the anti-Catholic mindset in Britain, isn't there? You know, we can't have a Catholic Prime Minister or Queen or whatever it is.
That's right. Well, I think it's the old mindset of the New World Order, because not only, I mean, Christians are going to be blocked from entering, but Catholics in particular.
Well, Catholics are the ones that the Jews really hate. They really got it in for Catholics.
Yeah, that's been the war, hasn't it, ever since Foot of the Cross?
Yeah. Well, I said I've got some quotes about slavery, and I have. I've got two pages here from a really, really good book. And that's They Were White and They Were Slaves, written by Michael Hoffman. And I've got two pages here about Irish slaves. And I'll read them out so you can hear just what went on with Cromwell's conquest of Ireland. Cromwell's conquest of Ireland in the middle of the 17th century made slaves as well as subjects of the Irish people. Over 100,000 men, women and children were seized by the English troops and shipped to the West Indies, where they were sold into slavery. And that's from George Novak's book, Slavery in Colonial America. On September the 11th, 1655, came the following decree from the Puritan Protectorate by Henry Cromwell in London. Concerning the young Irish women, although he must use force in taking them up, yet it being so much for their own good, and likely to be of so great advantage to the public, it is not in the least doubted that you may have such number of them as you think fit to make use upon this account. And the account was enslavement and transportation to the colonies. A week later, Henry Cromwell ordered that 1,500 Irish boys, aged 12 to 14, also be shipped into slavery with the Irish girls in the steaming tropics of Jamaica and Barbados, in circumstances which killed off white adult slaves by the thousands due to the rigours of fieldwork in that climate and the savage brutality of the overseers. In October, the Council of State approved the plan. Altogether, more than 100,000 Irish were shipped to the West Indies, where they died in slavery in horrible conditions. Children were not the only victims. Even 80-year-old Irish women were deported to the West Indies and enslaved. That's from D.M.R. Essen, The Curse of Cromwell, A History of the Ironside Conquest of Ireland. Irish religious leaders were herded into internment camps throughout Ireland and were then moved progressively to the posts for shipment overseas like cattle. By the time Cromwell's men had finished with the Irish people, only one-sixth of the Irish population remained on their lands. One-sixth. That means five-sixths of them were removed, either to either to the New World or off the land that he'd taken. Not quite clear which it is. But lest we think this is just about Catholics, Cromwell did not only enslave Catholics. Poor white Protestants on the English mainland fared no better. In February 1656, he ordered his soldiers to find 1,200 poor English women for enslavement and deportation to the colonies. In March, he repeated the order, but increased the quota to 2,000 young women of England. In the same year, Cromwell's Council of State ordered all the homeless poor of Scotland, male and female, transported to Jamaica for enslavement. Of course, Cromwell and the Puritan ruling class were not the only ones involved in the enslavement of whites. During the restoration reign of King Charles II, the monarch with Catholic sympathisers who had been Cromwell's arch enemy, the king enslaved large groups of poor Presbyterians and Scottish Covenanters and deported them to the plantations in turn. Legislation sponsored by King Charles II in 1686 intended to ensure the enslavement of Protestant rebels in the Caribbean colonies was so harsh that one observer noted the condition of these rebels was by this act made as bad, if not worse, than the Negroes. That's from Richard Hall, Acts Passed in the Island of Barbados. By far, the largest number and certainly the most important group of white indentured servants were the poor Protestants from Europe. And that's by Warren B. Smith. That's a story that we never hear about. The fact that the first slaves that were taken to America were white, and they were the ones that actually prepared the Caribbean for when the black slaves were taken there. And the whites were not used to the conditions, they were not used to the tropical conditions, and they died very, very quickly and very, very easily, unlike the Negroes, who it was just their natural habitat when they were actually taken there. And yet all we hear about today is the black slaves and how terrible we were to them. But it was actually white slavery that took place before then. And where it says the poor homeless, it doesn't mean like the homeless today that are sleeping on the streets. It just means anyone that does not landed gentry, anyone that isn't on the voting register as one of the nobles, people that, and when it says there that the Puritans owned all the land in Ireland, they did the same thing in Scotland, didn't they? They had the Highland clearances, where they just removed all the people that were living up there and said, well, this belongs to the crown now, and we're going to put sheep on this land. You know, our behaviour to ourselves has been far worse than our behaviour to the Negroes.
It blows a hole in the argument about the white race. I mean, it's obviously the whites have suffered as well. So it's not, you know, there's something not quite right with the people in charge, and I think we know what it is.
Well, quite clearly, and also it would have been interbreeding as well with the Jews, and we know how much the Jews were involved in this slave trade. Massively.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, they were owning the ships. They were the ones that lent the money so that this empire could be begun. This was a large part of why they wanted the Jews to come to England, was to set up the Bank of England so that they could then loan the money to form this East India Trading Company.
And that caused havoc.
Yeah, and the slavery and all the rest of it.
Drugging of China.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was Sassoon, the Jew, who was in charge of that little escapade. So, you know, there's some people hiding behind whites, if you like.
Oh, definitely. And they used the British Army to enforce the loans as well.
Just like they use the Americans today.
And even though we might say, this is slavery, we don't have this now, I really don't see it that different. I mean, they did have to look after the slaves. They did have to feed them and clothe them and give them a roof over their head. And when you think today, you could be paying 60% of your salary just for your rent or for your mortgage. And then if you've got to pay for clothes and food and bills, sometimes people have got nothing left at the end of their salary. And that means it's no different to how these slaves were treated. We just have this illusion, we've got the choice and we're the ones that actually pay out that money. But in a way, that just makes it even worse because, it's up to us to have to do that, to scrimp and save and worry if we haven't got enough money. Whereas if you were owned as a slave, you didn't have that worry. You know, that was guaranteed.
Had all of that. I just mention this because I might not ever get a chance to mention it again. But when I was looking research at all this, I actually found out that, we know that government lies to us. The Vietnam War, I always thought that we had no involvement. And I guess 99% of people out there thought Britain had no involvement listening tonight. When in fact, they did have involvement and there were medals presented with South Vietnam written on the medal.
What was that?
Just for thought.
What, the British Army were involved in it?
Yeah.
In what way? What fighting? Sending troops over?
Yeah. Well, they received medals for bravery.
Oh, I hadn't heard that. I mean, we don't really hear much about that over here. It's a huge thing in America, the Vietnam War and what went on there.
Australians were there, we know. I think New Zealanders were there. I never heard of the British being there until I was researching the other day.
No, I hadn't heard that. It'd be interesting to learn out more of what happened over there after the war. It was basically a big expansion of the New World Order, wasn't it? The Korean War.
I think they were fighting for the drug trade down there, weren't it?
It used to be the centre of the heroin trafficking, didn't it? And then that moved to Afghanistan.
Yeah, then they moved to Afghanistan for the poppies, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously you went into Burma and had the poppy trade from there, and then they moved from Burma to Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, like I said, what I'm trying to show people is the brutality of this Masonic Jewish empire. And this is only 20 years off the fight with National Socialism.
Well, another comment, which I haven't actually got on the list of comments here, but someone was talking about the Orange Order and the marches that they have, and that's obviously to do with William of Orange, who came into power after Charles II. He was linked up with this as well. I mean, it was these Dutch Jews that were in Holland that funded Cromwell, and they were also funding William of Orange. And after Charles II, they brought this Dutch guy over, this Dutch king, William of Orange, over into Britain and made him king. And the Orange Order in Northern Ireland, they're very supportive of him. And there's
they've no idea the real story behind it all.
Yeah, it's a shame. There's a big mural of Oliver Cromwell up there as well. I mean, Cromwell was just a bastard. We just heard what he did to the Protestants as well as the Catholics. Yeah. Worst thing that ever happened to Great Britain was Oliver Cromwell. I think
it's the hiding of history which does the most damage, which they're really good at, as you know.
Well, I think we're still paying for it today, Dennis. I mean, look at the state of our royal family. They've got no concern whatsoever for their subjects. Queen's got no concern.
We talked about this after World War II. They're all outside the gate and it was a sea of white faces. And obviously Churchill and the royal family must have known the situation because Churchill in 1946 gave a speech in Zurich in Switzerland commending Coon of Killarney and his plan. So, nothing's changed. The Queen's never come out and mentioned anything about the lack of white faces in London today.
Well, I think the Queen just thinks, well, you killed your king. You killed my ancestor. Why should I care about you? That's what I mean by we've still got the effect of it today.
Well, I think it's more than that. I think when the Jews took over, they made sure that the royal families were all looked after, and they do make them a lot of money, a hell of a lot of money, and they have done over the years. Different monarchs,
the Jews have always been the king's property, haven't they? They were the king's Jews.
Yeah.
So they were owned by them.
They took great delight in South Africa and one or two other places to get the gold and diamonds.
Well, you brought up Winston Churchill just then, and he pops up in your video as well. So what did Winston Churchill have to do with Ireland?
Well, he became the Minister of War and of Air. He actually wanted to send planes over to bomb Ireland, which shouldn't be a surprise to anybody.
So he was the Minister of Era, the Minister of Ireland, and he wanted to bomb Era.
No, I don't think it was Minister of Era. It was the Minister of War and of Air, they called it.
Right.
Airplanes.
Gotcha. I was thinking they put him in charge of Ireland. What have the Irish done to deserve that?
Well, like I said, it isn't that long after the South African debacle, and he was only a journalist then. So he's come up in the world since, obviously.
So this was before the Second World War that he was involved in Ireland?
This is, easily before Second World War, yeah. I think World War One was still going on.
Right. Well, we've got another comment here from Seda Vacante. Seat vacant, I think that means. So it means that the Pope's seat is vacant. And he says, another great video. I have one question, though. From what I can find, King Charles was Protestant but married to a Catholic. Do you have any source information that shows he was a Catholic?
Yeah, that was my mistake. I thought he was. It's certainly Catholic sympathies, and he married a Catholic. And for some unknown reason, I thought he was Catholic. But he was Protestant with Catholic sympathies. I've amended that in the master episode.
Well, the important thing is, I mean, he was open to both, wasn't he? He wanted to find a solution that helped the Catholics and also helped the Protestants. This is
why the right thing to do.
This is why you say Charles I was a good king. He wasn't hated by his people. It was just Cromwell that wanted to kill him because that's what the Jews wanted. And you
that's
make
what
it
the
clear
Jews demanded, before the law.
Yeah, well, you make it clear in the video that he wasn't found guilty by the British people, and they couldn't actually find a prosecutor that was going to prosecute the king, and they ended up with a Jewish prosecutor that prosecuted the king. And I think we said a couple of weeks ago as well about how Oliver Cromwell just grabbed the pen and signed it. He was just so desperate to get rid of the king and have himself put in place of the king, which is what happened.
And he wanted the blood money.
And what was he, Lord Protector? Some grandiose title that he gave to himself?
That's right.
I mean, that's the mentality of the Bolshevik, isn't it? You know, it doesn't matter the breeding. Anyone could just be king. And you hear this a lot. Oh, it's just an accident of birth. Well, why should these people have it all and we don't? Well, you know, it's because of the breeding, and that's the position they had in society. You have a hierarchy. You have people that, you know, are brought up to do these jobs, and that's the system that works the best. If you think about it, if you've got someone that, you know, not just a king, but if somebody's a cobbler or somebody's, an intellectual or an artist or a musician, and they're brought up from a very early age to see the field of work that their father does, and they're taught everything that their father does, and then when they get to an adult's age, they're going to be as good or better than their father was, and then they're going to teach their son to be the same. Which means that when you had these classes or you had these castes, they were all very good at what they did. And when you look at what the king had, the king was given the very best education from a very early age. And he was given the best chances in life, you know, the best chances to go hunting, the best chances to fight, because he always used to be at the front of the battlefield as well, defending his people. And you wanted someone who was the very best of everything, because not everybody can have the best of everything.
That's right.
But at least one person could have the best of everything, and that one person could be your champion.
I think that's what happened after World War One. A lot of the monarchs fell, and the surviving monarchs eventually fell in line for the New World Order. You look at the monarchy in Holland and in Spain. They all fall in line.
They've all capitulated, and the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion talk about it, don't they?
And it mentions it in that, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to get rid of the kings, and religion, Catholicism, that's the main enemy, and the kings.
That's
and they've done that. And we'll con the people into thinking that they can rule themselves. Democracy.
Exactly.
Lie. Got another comment here from Robert Cathcart. And he says, what eventually happened to the Black and Tans? Don't tell me they became the RUC. Surely not. So what happened to the Black and Tans?
Well, maybe some what were from Ireland, because there were some from Ireland. The only one who was ever charged and hung was from Dublin, believe it or not. But they were disbanded after the peace treaty. The thing is that for all they did, because they did do some damage, they did murder at will, and they did burn down houses, and they did whatever they wanted. I mean, the first I heard of them was a rumour that Mel Gibson's grandmother had been raped by them. That's how I first heard of the Black and Tans. Whether that's true or not, I do not know. But that's why I was curious to investigate when I got the chance. So consequently, like I said, there is some people who regard them as out-and-out criminals who were sent over to Ireland because of the freedom. In exchange for the freedom. And certainly there were still soldiers from World War One, I don't doubt. But at the end of the day, they were a renegade bunch, if you like.
Well, the idea was that the Irish stopped obeying the police, didn't they? And they started having these guerrilla attacks. So what the British said...
Yeah, the police had to move into the barracks. The ones in the countryside, they were open for attack, yeah.
So what the British said is, right, we'll have a force that's a cross between the police and the army, and they'll shoot first and I'll ask questions later. And that was the idea.
Burn down your house, ask questions.
Yeah, there was that, wasn't there? That, you know, there was looting, there was, yeah. I forget, there was one town that was burnt down and destroyed. And
they burnt a few towns. At the end of the video, it shows Cork. And what they did, they went to Cork, a band of them for revenge for the, I think, do an ambush and 11 of them were killed. So they jumped in the trucks and they headed for Cork because, like I said, Cork were a centre of IRA activity. And they stopped all the ambulances and all the fire brigades from putting the fire out and just let the city burn. But they looted the jewels, the jurors. You know, first, and they took the watches and the gold chains and whatever first.
I was absolutely barbaric.
Which is not the British Army. That is not what people think of the British Army, for sure.
No, but, you know, from what I can see of it, I mean, it's on both sides. I mean, you've got the IRA that are being barbaric as well. You've got the British Army that are doing the same. You've got the IRA that have got guerrilla tactics.
It's two ruthless organisations, without a doubt.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, two wrongs don't make a right. That's the thing. I mean, it started off with, you know, the British being at war in World War One, and then this rising which took place, which was seen as treachery, wasn't it? It was seen as treachery by the Irish as well. They were
even by the
throwing
Irish, yeah.
Rocks.
But I suppose if you're a nationalist, it is the time to attempt it, but that's up for debate. Again, you know, I mean, if this was taking place in England, I could understand more against the IRA. But because all this was taking in their happening in their country, they were fighting for, you know, to govern their own country. Then, to a certain extent, you know, when the British came over to do what they did, as the Black and Tans did, I find it hard to imagine a British army being that wild.
Well, they lost the moral high ground, didn't they? When they started executing them, when they started executing the people in the rising, and it was because of that this guerrilla army formed, and because of the guerrilla army, you got the Black and Tans, and because of the Black and Tans actions, you got this, that, and the other, and it went on for decades, didn't it? Almost a century it went on for before they had the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, well, there was an intermittent break. I think the trouble started late 60s up in Northern Ireland. But that's a whole different ballgame. You know, I mean, this is a separate ballgame, this one down in the south.
And you've also got, you know, lots of double agents as well. I mean, it came to a stage where the IRA, majority of them were British intelligence agents, I hear, at one stage.
Yeah, not only that, there's a, can't remember the name of the hotel now, but it was known for a paedophile ring in London. And there were members of Thatcher's government used to visit, and also members of the IRA at a time when that war was going on in the 80s.
I can remember reading about it. Well, have you got any plans for part 12 yet, Dennis? What's coming up in the future in the series?
I think, because I've said these things before, I've been taking down other avenues, but I think what I'm going to try and show is leading up to World War One now, once the victory was complete, I'm going to show just what a Jewish victory it was, with all the representatives of the Allies being represented by a Jewish banker.
And this is after the
this
first
is at
war.
Versailles. This is at Versailles. The Pope is banned. The Pope's not allowed to go to this where the treaty was. And also, like I said, the English, the Americans, and the French all had a Jewish banker representing them, because, it's a banker's war. And so is World War II. And this is what I'm going to try and show. Whether or not that'll be the next episode, I think it will be. But who knows?
Well, I've been learning a bit about that myself just recently. Ted Midward's been doing an excellent series based on Henry Ford's The International Jew.
And he's finance dealer, yeah.
Yeah, the last couple of episodes, he's been talking about the banking system and the Jews, and parts of it, one part of it, he was saying that during the war, it was Jews that were representing all the countries in Europe and Jews that were representing America. And they were the ones that were doing all the deals. They were the diplomats. They were like the representative of France was a Jew. The representative of Germany was a Jew. The representative of America was a Jew. And they were all tied in with Schiff and Max Warburg. Yeah, this whole network of Jews that were controlling the war and profiting from both sides.
They were advising these people like Woodrow Wilson and Lloyd George, saying they're advising. They weren't advising them. They were actually in charge, as we know.
Well, we know how much influence they had by being able to bargain, for Palestine, to say, we'll bring America into the war if you give us Palestine, with the Balfour Declaration. That shows you how much power that they actually had. They were controlling America.
Well, just like they took over the Bank of England, or instated the Bank of England, and then put the country in debt, and then obviously managed to control the country. They did the same in America with the Federal Reserve.
The same thing, isn't it? All based on usury, all based on this ever-expanding debt, and you cannot pay back what you've already borrowed without creating more debt, so that there's more currency in circulation.
Yeah, that's the thing. Silent means of taking a country over.
Yeah, and of course it continually expands, and the continual expansion means that you get continual inflation, which means that what you have isn't worth as much anymore. When you're earning your money, it gradually gets worth less and less and less, and you can buy less and less and less with it.
And we saw in the 20s how they kind of flooded the market with money. People were actually enjoying life during the 20s, and then suddenly in the 30s, the banks crashed everything because everybody had took out mortgages, etc. And so all this property then went back into the banks for pennies.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it?
Something they've done for a long while.
When they do that, then they can buy everything back and say, oh, it all belongs to us now.
Well, they buy it, they really just go take it.
Well, they've never even put any money up in the first place. That's the thing.
No,
they don't put up anything of commensurate value. All they do is monetize your promise to pay them back. That's where all the money comes from. All right, Dennis.
We're paying for that debt. Okay.
Well, it'll never get paid back. As I say, they've got to keep creating more and more debt to put money into circulation to pay back the original loan. And that will never end until you get rid of usury. And you'll never get rid of usury all the while you've got Jews running the banking system, because that's all they know how to do. They admitted that in their letter to Oliver Cromwell, begging to be allowed back into Britain. They say, all we know how to do is usury. That's all we can do. We're not capable of doing anything else. But look at how rich we've made the countries that allow us to operate our usury in them. That's the basis of his argument. I forget what his name is, but he's got a quite a hilarious name as well. He's just desperate to make himself appear like he's connected to the Old Testament. worth reading. All right, Dennis.
Okay.
Thanks for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you, and we do hope you all have a great weekend ahead of you.